The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
We hate referees in this country. We object to the power that others have. And so I think that we need to accept that platforms exercise editorial judgment. They do it in ways that are both visible and invisible. They have a right to do it under the current law. And there are going to be cases where they exercise editorial judgment in service of the broader information ecosystem that may not first appear on their face to be consistent with their policies, but are consistent with the general mission that we have given them. So my view is just, if you believe that they should actively intervene to prevent the spread of disinformation campaigns, they're going to have to react really quickly sometimes, and it's going to be messy. Now, if your position is, well, actually, I don't think they should intervene to stop disinformation campaigns at all, that's fine, and you should make that case, but just know that that is not the message that they have been receiving for the past 3 years.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 29th, 2020. It's another episode of our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation. This week, Evelyn Dweck and I spoke to Casey Newton, the veteran Silicon Valley editor for The Verge, who recently went independent to start a newsletter on Substack called Platformer. Few people have followed the stories of platforms and content moderation in recent years as closely and carefully as Casey. So we asked him about what's changed in the last 4 years, especially in the lead up to the election. We also spoke about the challenges of reporting on the tech industry and whether platforms' increased willingness to get their hands dirty in content moderation means we'll have to change the name of our podcast as their claims that they're not arbiters of truth begins to ring increasingly hollow. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 29th. Casey Newton on 4 years of platform chaos.
So your newsletter, Platformer, is essentially the only newsletter that I would say is absolutely indispensable to my workflow. You always provide a smart and unique take on the platform news of the day, and you round up the most important links. I signed up immediately when you launched a few weeks ago, even though as a student it means I won't eat for a week, but you know, that's a sacrifice I'm willing to make. So why is your newsletter so indispensable? How do you think about what it is that you're offering that I can't get anywhere else?
Well, first of all, you're very kind, and I should say that your tweets regularly provide fodder for my newsletter, and there have been many days where I have woken up wondering what I was going to write about, and then you say something smart, and I think, oh, I could definitely get a column out of that.
So you still don't comp me. I mean, come on.
I know. Capitalism is so brutal. You know, I think about it in a couple of ways. I started Platformer and its predecessor, The Interface, because the subjects that I was interested in didn't have a central repository where I could go to each day and figure out what had happened in that world. There were some good substitutes like TechMeme that had a lot of what I was interested in, but they didn't have everything. They didn't organize it the way that I would have. And so I really kind of wanted that at a glance look at basically what happened on my beat today. And so I started putting it together in a newsletter. And what I found was there was a pretty healthy community of people who wanted that kind of at a glance look at the day in big social networks, platforms, democracy, and a bunch of sub-themes. So, you know, misinformation and disinformation is a big one. And so I just kind of started to build that out and, you know, have been fortunate to find a paying audience. So it's been the most fun I've had in my career, I would say.
you know, in launching Platformer, you're obviously moving on to a platform, specifically Substack, which is this newsletter service that has been very engaged recently in recruiting journalists to kind of go solo and start using their services. You've obviously thought and reported pretty deeply on the role of internet platforms right now and the difficulty of managing those platforms. So I'm curious how you're thinking about launching a journalistic enterprise on a platform. Like, are you going to, you know, test and see if you can break Substack's terms of service? Like, how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, the entire thing is just basically a stress test of the TOS. And as soon as it breaks, then I'm leaving. No, you know, it's a good and a fair question. And, you know, I could give a sort of long answer to it. I'll try to give the more concise one. Basically, I knew that I wanted to start a paid newsletter. It felt like my best options were either one, to do it on Substack, or two, to roll my own on WordPress. And when I looked at the time frame that I had, which was, I thought it was important that I start this before the election, increasingly speed became a priority. And on Substack, you can just basically upload a logo and snap your fingers and you've got yourself a publication. So because it was so easy, that made it really appealing. They also offered me a couple of things as a nervous first-time entrepreneur that made Substack more appealing, the biggest of which was this legal defender program. So if I ever, you know, irritate a litigious billionaire, Substack may have my back. They're not obligated to, but I think they would be, you know, heavily incentivized to defend their writers in a case like that. They also helped me figure out healthcare and offered me a small subsidy for at least a year. And so that just sort of made it feel like, you know what, I have no idea if this is going to work or not. All of these things make me slightly more comfortable in making the leap. So I'm going to make the leap. So, but, you know, as you point out, platforms have dynamics. They often unfold in exactly one way, which is that the platform exerts more control and authority over time and the creators get irritated and flee. And so I totally acknowledge that that is a real dynamic. I would love it if Substack could escape that. I think they seem far more attuned to the needs of their creators than many platforms have, particularly at this stage of their development. But we'll just have to see. And either way, I am committed to writing about it on Platformer, even though, of course, I will have to acknowledge the many, many ways in which I am conflicted in that case.
So Platformer is a successor newsletter to The Interface, which you started at The Verge in 2017. And those 4 years have been, in many ways, some of the most eventful for platforms. It's sort of traced the so-called tech lash that was in part kicked off by the revelations of Russian interference in the 2016 election and is now in full swing with not one but two congressional hearings with tech CEOs in the next few weeks and, you know, however many Section 230 bills on the Hill at the moment. So I'm just curious, what would you say the biggest changes from when you started your first newsletter to now when you're starting your second?
Gosh, so many changes. I would just throw out a couple. I mean, one is when I started The Interface, I felt like I was among the more vocal critics of the platforms. But as the years have gone on and more critics have started to speak out on these issues, I increasingly feel like a centrist or like moderate, right? Because it's like so many people have just had it with platforms. They think that all of the CEOs should basically just go to jail and that the platforms should all be shut down and we should start from scratch. I don't feel that way. And so now I sort of sometimes feel uncomfortable, like I'm carrying water for the platforms. But that's just sort of my personal emotional journey of writing this newsletter. You know, I mean, I think, you know, probably the most prominent change, and you mentioned it, is the government is starting to pay real attention to these issues. And of course, Republicans and Democrats have completely opposite views on what they think should happen. But at the same time, we now have an antitrust lawsuit underway against Google. And apparently, we may have one underway against Facebook by November. So there was a time when I would regularly write in my columns, there is no meaningful antitrust enforcement in this country. And that is no longer true. And I think that that is like kind of a good symbolic indication of the shift in perception, but also the increase in education among members of Congress about how these companies work and what are some of the issues that they've created. So those are a couple of things I would point to.
Let's talk about disinformation specifically within that space. So over the course of the same 4 years, we've sort of gone from Mark Zuckerberg saying that the idea that foreign influence on Facebook might have affected the 2016 election is pretty crazy, to Facebook just constantly deluging, you know, my social media feed and newspapers and everything, saying, you know, how very seriously they're taking the 2020 election and their role in it. Do you think that reflects a genuine change in how platforms generally and Facebook specifically view the threat, or a change just in how they think society and therefore their customers are thinking about these issues?
I think they do take it much more seriously. And the Hunter Biden New York Post story, which I imagine we'll get into, is really the best exemplar of that, right? You had these platforms under heavy criticism for years that they had not noticed Russian interference in the election soon enough. They had not alerted the public to it soon enough. And Americans basically demanded that these platforms take a more active interventionist role in rooting out these kinds of campaigns. And so then the Hunter Biden story lands in the Post, and the platforms sort of detected that this seemed like a hack and leak campaign. And so they acted on it, and then all hell broke loose.
Okay, yeah, so let's dig into that a bit more then. You know, what do you think platforms are getting right for the 2020 election, and what are you still worried about? And if it's helpful to talk that through the lens of the New York Post example, then that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, so some things that they're getting right. One, they are doing a great deal more to identify and label misinformation, particularly as it relates to voting methods, right? So they are, you know, identifying posts that are saying that, you know, mail-in ballots will lead to fraud, and they're sort of proactively saying, you know that that is not true. So I think that that is a useful thing. Most of the platforms have undertaken get out the vote efforts, which I think have been pretty successful. Facebook says it's already registered 1.5 million people, and that was several weeks ago. I'm sure the number is higher now. So I think that's good. And they've also started to game out the aftermath of the election, right? There was a story in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend about how Facebook is thinking about measures it might undertake to effectively slow down the spread of content on the network, assuming that there would be unrest in the United States after the election. So just generally speaking, I think there has been a lot more proactive thinking and gaming out scenarios for 2020 than there was in 2016. So, you know, that's good. I think where things are bad, you know, one, there is just the phenomenon that it seems like it is the most angry, hyper-partisan posts that continue to thrive on Facebook. It is in no way a balanced information ecosystem. I logged onto CrowdTangle today, and Donald Trump had a 96% share of voice on the platform compared to Joe Biden, who had a 3%. I'm not exactly sure how they measure share of voice, but you know, Trump has more than 10 times as many followers on his page as Biden does. And you just sort of look at which posts are getting the most engagement, and it tends to be this real hyper-partisan stuff. And then the other thing is, even though we know that Facebook recommendations push people toward a lot of bad groups, they still basically sat idly by while QAnon exploded on the platform this year. Various militia groups grew extremely rapidly on the platform this year. And even though from the moment that Mark Zuckerberg said that Facebook was going to pivot to these private groups, people have been warning that some of those groups were going to have really bad intentions, this stuff has sort of happened anyway. So that's a place where they haven't been as proactive and where we've seen some really unfortunate consequences.
Okay, so on the New York Post example then, I think it's a good example because I think it shows what you were saying, that they were being proactive. They kind of leapt on it very quickly and took some pretty unusual actions, certainly actions that we wouldn't have seen them take in 2016. But I think you and I might have a different take on whether that was a success story or not. So let me sort of lay out what I think about that, and you can tell me where I'm wrong.
Please.
And it's that, you know, in some ways, they took these sort of apparently exceptional actions without really justifying them on the face of their policies. Certainly, you know, Facebook said it's downranking this story on the basis of signals. It didn't explain what the signals were. It didn't explain how much it was downranking it. And then Twitter took the nuclear option of banning the links entirely. And for a number of hours, we didn't know on what basis. It later came out that it was a fairly clear application of its policy not to post personal information. But then when people got angry about that, they reversed the policy. And it sort of just seemed to me that the way that these platforms were sort of not sticking to their written policies really opened them up to the charges of bias that inevitably followed about, you know, the fact that they were biased against conservatives trying to suppress the story in the favor of Biden. And I just wonder whether, you know, in sort of thinking about it purely on the basis of the story entirely, you know, platforms are trying to step into the breach and in doing so, create a meta story and sort of Streisand effect the whole thing, when it would just be better for them to really sort of tie themselves to the mast of what they said they were going to do in those situations.
Yes. I mean, I think that's like, that is a totally fine and acceptable worldview. And I don't even really disagree with anything that you're saying. I think that, yes, it would be better for platforms to have clearly stated policies and follow them in every case and be extremely transparent about all of it. I want to live in that world too. I have criticized platforms for not doing that exact thing. I want them to move in that direction. You know, on this particular case, though, I think a good question to ask is, if Facebook and Twitter did just continue enforcing their policies perfectly forever, would charges of bias go away? Would Republicans and Democrats be any less upset with them about the things that are allowed on the platform or not allowed on the platform? And the answer is no. Everyone has an interest in working the refs. Everyone has an interest in just lodging perpetual ongoing grievances against these platforms and saying that they're rigged against us no matter what the data shows. And the reason is because we hate referees in this country. We object to the power that others have. And so I think that we need to accept that platforms exercise editorial judgment. They do it in ways that are both visible and invisible. They have a right to do it under the current law. And there are going to be cases where they exercise editorial judgment in service of the broader information ecosystem that may not first appear on their face to be consistent with their policies, but are consistent with the general mission that we have given them. So my view is just, if you believe that they should actively intervene to prevent the spread of disinformation campaigns, they're going to have to react really quickly sometimes, and it's going to be messy. Now, if your position is, well, actually, I don't think they should intervene to stop disinformation campaigns at all, that's fine, and you should make that case. But just know that that is not the message that they have been receiving for the past 3 years.
Yeah. So when you say the mission that we've given them, I'm curious what you mean by that, because it's actually something that I've been thinking about a lot, of sort of what expectations the public puts on these platforms as a sort of alternative sphere of governance, and how that makes them fall down sometimes on the job. So can you just talk a little bit more about like what you mean by that? Is it an issue of public pressure to sort of step in and clean things up when something like the New York Post story bursts onto the scene?
Absolutely. You know, it starts with the press coverage in the wake of the 2016 election, much of which closely examined the effects of disinformation campaigns. It extended into the political scientists who studied the effects of disinformation campaigns on the 2016 election, and, you know, some of which concluded that it had an effect on the outcome. And then it goes to our current politicians, many of whom have excoriated Facebook for not doing more to stop the spread of disinformation campaigns. And so if you're Facebook and you're a public company and you're trying to navigate these regulatory waters, you've gotten this incredibly powerful signal that a key priority for you in the next election is to protect the integrity of those elections. And, you know, I think it might just be, you know, fun to have the thought experiment of, let's say that, you know, the Hunter Biden story comes along, the platforms do nothing to stop its spread, it goes crazy on Twitter, the New York Times starts writing about it as just kind of a straightforward news story, while, you know, of course, acknowledging there are some concerns about the provenance of these documents. But, you know, you can sort of, it's not hard for me to imagine this becoming WikiLeaks 2020, right? And then imagine that Trump wins. And then what is the conversation going to be for the next 4 years? It's going to be, well, the Hunter Biden story came along and the platforms did nothing to intervene. They learned nothing from 2016. And then they're in for another 4 years of being beaten up. So that's just an element of this story that I never see discussed. And I wonder if you two sort of have views on why that is, if I'm misreading it somehow.
No, I mean, I think I broadly agree with that, that at the moment, you know, there were no good options. I think, you know, you've written about this as well. It's sort of trying to make take the least worst option in so many cases. But I think perhaps you and I just maybe differ on how the metrics that we use to evaluate how the platforms have succeeded or not. And for me, I think, you know, I'm a process person and I like having clear rules as much as possible in advance and sticking to them, because I sort of strongly feel if we're going to see this again and again over the coming weeks, the surest guide to platforms weathering the oncoming storm will be to be able to point to their policies as we go. And I guess it's kind of this idea of they may have won the battle in that particular case, but it's kind of the war of reestablishing trust in the online information ecosystem and whether the whole thing's rigged or not that I'm concerned about. But obviously, you know, a lot of that is based on speculation of, you know, exactly how important would this story have been and what were the effects of it and et cetera, which is, you know, no one can really know. So yeah, no, I would agree with that.
Also, like, every major information platform is now subject to constant criticism that it is rigged, whether we're talking about Facebook or Twitter or Fox News or the New York Times. Like, if the platform is big enough, then the entire meta discussion around the platform is how unfair it is to whatever group that people, you know, think is disfavored. And so I just think part of the like growing up of these platforms is going to be to understand that they have no way to win and that they can only make decisions based on, you know, their principles and their values and their mission, you know, and just their desire for self-preservation. So yeah, I mean, again, I hear what you're saying. I wish that there was a process that they followed, and we should continue to encourage them to do that, you know, as these things keep happening. But, you know, at the same time, like, for all of the cries of censorship and, oh, the horrible precedent of, you know, you couldn't DM this link using Twitter DMs, you know, all of this was so temporary, right? It was all over like within 24 hours. This was not like a lifetime ban on discussing Hunter Biden and the New York Post. So all it really did effectively was slow down the spread of the story, but also draw attention to how shady the story was. And I actually think that's like a really good use of a media platform, right? When something really suspicious comes along, to encourage people to slow down and take a deep breath and to consider that whoever is sharing it, you know, may have an ulterior motive. That's actually the way that journalists act when they're deciding whether to share things that are leaked to them. So I actually, like, maybe that's why I feel like such a like strange like kinship with Facebook and Twitter in this case, is because they applied essentially journalistic values to this story.
So I know that Quinto wants to jump in on that, and I'll hand it over to her quickly. But I just want to say, you know, the thing that you're not saying that other less polite people have said to me is that I understand that my point of view is a very naive one about like trying to hold on to process as some sort of safety mechanism in times of stress, and that perhaps, you know, judgment calls and values are ultimately unavoidable. But I also just want to strongly second the other thing that you said about, you know, the meta-narratives that get created about platform actions in the aftermath of any particular action. So, you know, we have all of this story about like what Twitter did and what Facebook did. And, you know, they were only blocked on Twitter for a certain amount of time. And then by contrast, we have this like big story about what Facebook did in downranking it. And we actually have no idea what Facebook did. And it still got plenty of shares and views and links. And we have no idea what signals it relied on in doing what it did. And yet we have this whole story about all these platform actions that we actually have no idea what they were.
Yeah, it's a really important point. And, you know, at least one of the Facebook posts about the Biden situation was viewed millions of times on Facebook, right? So if you're, you know, worried about censorship, you really don't have all that much to be worried about here, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, so when Evelyn says I wanted to jump in, it's because I've been talking endlessly about this story over the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's interesting. So Ben Smith at the New York Times had a really interesting column on how the Wall Street Journal's, the news side as opposed to the editorial side, essentially was handed the Hunter Biden story on a silver platter and dug into it, basically found that there was nothing there and sort of wrote not the version of the story that the Trump campaign was looking at. And Smith's point was that the sort of, you know, the big media gatekeepers in his view are returning and sort of putting up the walls and saying, we're going to gauge what is and isn't newsworthy. And Casey, I mean, it strikes me that in a way, as you say, the platforms are acting like newspapers and the newspapers are also acting like newspapers or maybe like platforms. Yeah. Everyone is sort of saying like, okay, hold on, let's take a minute and see what's really going on here. And though we didn't know it at the time, it really does seem like what Facebook and Twitter were doing, with or without a rule book, as Evelyn points out, is really comparable to what the Journal was doing, which is saying, let's sit on this and sort of tamp down the circulation until we can figure out what the hell was going on. And in that way, it strikes me that Facebook and Twitter are sort of responding to the same incentives that, in this case, the Journal and really the traditional media more broadly are responding to, where they sort of don't want to get caught with their pants down either. And so everyone is ending up acting a lot more responsibly, I would argue, than they did in 2016, though it's perhaps more notable to our eyes that Facebook and Twitter are doing so because for so long they've explicitly refused to acknowledge that they're taking that kind of editorial role.
Yeah, I think all of that is right. And I think it's okay that we're really concerned because these platforms are where a great deal of online political speech happens, and where the boundaries get drawn are arguably more consequential than where the boundaries get drawn, even at a major national newspaper, right? Just because the audience that Facebook in particular serves is so much larger. So I think it's totally appropriate to bring kind of outsized skepticism and scrutiny to where they are drawing those lines. But, you know, and I mean, this is why I can write four columns a week. Like the question of where to draw the lines is impossible. And so all you have is like people navigating bad trade-offs and outraging hundreds of millions of people around the world every day.
Yeah, I've often joked that this whole thing is a full employment program for academics and journalists, because it's really hard and we are not solving it anytime soon, in my opinion. So I think you and I, you know, we picked a good topic, Casey. I'm curious then, like, given what you're saying about sort of viewing them more through an editorial lens and making these judgment calls, like, are we going to have to change our podcast name? Like, is the arbiters of truth, you know, we're not arbiters of truth ideal such that it ever was going to be out of vogue? Do you think it ever really was sort of an ideological statement, or it was always sort of like a self-serving, cynical invocation to protect the business model? And do you think there is sort of going to be a movement away from that to being more hands-on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was arguably untrue even when, I think, was it Mark Zuckerberg who first introduced that term into the lexicon? He's the first person I can remember saying.
Yeah, I think that's right,
yeah. Yeah, Jack Dorsey has adopted it afterwards. But it was always false, because I think even when Zuckerberg first said it, you couldn't go on Facebook and say the United States election is on November 10th and don't forget that Democrats vote a week later, or, you know, some sort of obvious fraud like that. Facebook had just decided that that was not true, and so it would remove it. And then COVID-19 came along, and there were all of these other obviously untrue things that they were going to prevent you from saying, right? If you wanted to say that injecting bleach into your veins would cure your COVID, they would remove that. And so every week, it seemed like there was some new category of things about which Facebook was happy to serve as arbiter of truth. And you can imagine that that list is much more likely to expand dramatically over time than it is to shrink dramatically over time. So, you know, I can't speak to the name of your podcast. Maybe it'll just become like a kitschy retro throwback to a previous era of platform governance. But I do think for the platforms themselves, that era has passed us by.
I love the idea of the podcast title as kitschy and retro, or any podcast title as kitschy and retro. Yeah. So we wanted to ask you a bit what it's like to report on these platforms. You've broken some really big pieces based on scoops from company insiders, especially about the really horrifying conditions that human content moderators work in for Facebook. But in general, I think there's a sense that it's really just hard to get answers from these companies. Columbia Journalism Review did a big piece recently on how Facebook obfuscates and gaslights journalists, and it includes a story about how Facebook lied to you about a test flight of a drone in 2016 that's saying it had gone smoothly when it crashed. So do you trust these companies' statements to you?
I think I trust them more than I used to. Like, we just kind of, sometimes you just go like round and around with people and you fight with them for a long time. And then they're finally like, okay, like, we'll level with you. Like, that's like sort of how I feel like what has happened with me and Facebook. Like, there was this, you know, there was this era of my reporting career where I was writing, you know, much like fluffier access driven pieces. And then the 2016 election happened and I realized I'd been missing enormous parts of the story. And so I started to kind of reorient, you know, what I was doing. You know, and it's also true that there are good PR people and there are bad PR people. And that's true of, you know, every major tech platform. And I've worked with both kinds. I would say that there are some folks there who work really hard to get me accurate information. In fact, even when I was writing those content moderation pieces, which were extremely critical of how the company had operated in that capacity, the PR person there, a woman named Carolyn Glanville, went to some pretty heroic lengths to get me inside the content moderation facilities to let me talk to some, you know, other moderators besides the ones that I was talking to, and did it all in a pretty short time frame. So, you know, you just sort of never know. I don't know. Like, one of the things I like writing about Facebook is it is a company that is sensitive to public pressure. Like, it cares what people are saying about it. And that's actually not true of Apple. It's not true of Amazon, right? Like, not in any real way. You know, Tesla just famously disbanded its entire PR department. Like, you can't even get a PR person on the phone to get you a no comment. So, you know, in comparison to that, I feel like I have it pretty easy working with Facebook, with Twitter, with Google, with Snap. Like, all of those platforms are pretty good about, you know, getting me the official like comment or no comment or maybe some, you know, background guidance here or background briefing there. So I feel good in that regard. You know, but it's also true that I'm sure not everyone has that experience because they have limited bandwidth and capacity, and they will make choices about whose call they're going to return based on which stories they think are going to have impact. That's, I don't know, that's kind of my rambly answer to that.
No, I think it's useful, and I want to pick up on it and ask you about something that I've come to think of as the YouTube problem. Right. So it's this, that we spend so much time debating Facebook and Twitter's policy updates, in large part because they make transparent announcements about policy updates. And like, we just spent a whole amount of time talking about their response to the New York Post story because they were telling us what they were doing in that situation. Whereas YouTube sort of just keeps its head down and tries to let the other platforms take the heat. And then, you know, a couple of days later releases some statement saying, yeah, we're not taking any action. And, you know, this is like a common theme. Like, they only released a pandemic misinformation policy on May 20, which is, you know, quite late in the year. They have far less transparent updates about foreign interference takedowns. It still doesn't have a claim about what it will do for false claims of election victory. So apart from just YouTube bashing, the point of this question is, do you feel like there's this sense in which it's hard to write a story about nothing, but that results in sort of disproportionate scrutiny on the platforms that, you know, do things and tell us about them in such that we, you know, we create bad transparency incentives, I think, when we do that. What's your reaction to that?
I think it's a good point, and I really appreciate the continued attention that you bring to the fact that YouTube often does sit out these debates in an entirely self-serving way, because I think it is super important. I would say it's an actual good use of Twitter because it's like it's sometimes not enough for a column, but it's like a perfect idea to fit in a tweet, right? So it's one of the rare cases where I would just encourage a person to keep tweeting about something. You know, at the same time, we have also seen really good reporting on YouTube and the way that it has been used to radicalize people. There's been pretty great coverage of its algorithmic recommendations over the years, and YouTube actually has changed its policies a lot, kind of in anticipation of what other platforms would do, but also kind of more often in reaction to what other platforms are doing. So they're definitely trying to keep their heads down more than some of the other platforms.
I think the fact that they're owned by Google just sort of gives them enormous cover, right? Like YouTube isn't directly answerable to shareholders. You know, YouTube doesn't have to give a quarterly report on anything. And so, yeah, so it is a blind spot in our understanding. And thank you for reminding me that I need to think more about how to correct for that in the work I'm doing.
I wasn't meaning to reprimand you, just to be clear. But thank you for the advice to keep tweeting.
Yeah, possibly the only time someone has ever been told on this podcast to keep tweeting. So I wanted to zoom out a little bit to talk about tech coverage in general. I think that there's possibly because of how much, as you say, Facebook really cares about what people think of it, there's an interesting dynamic that's taken hold over the last few years between journalists and platforms. And actually, you did an interview recently with Sarah Jung about launching Platformer, where you made this point that once journalists figured out you could get infinite retweets by typing Facebook is bad into a box, it changed the tenor of the coverage. So I'd love to hear you expand more on that. Like, what do you think about the state of tech reporting right now? Is it overly confrontational because of these incentives?
To some degree, yes, particularly on Twitter. I think Twitter has had a huge warping effect on tech coverage. You know, when I talk about this, I always like to just start by reiterating that I think broadly tech coverage is really good. And I think it's way better today than it was 4 years ago. I think that this industry has benefited hugely from the added scrutiny that it has gotten from tech reporters. My newsletter would not exist without the incredible work of those tech reporters. And I know way more about the inner workings of tech companies today than I did 4 years ago or 10 years ago. And that's all thanks to their hard work. So I think it's really important to ground that discussion, because a lot of the sort of what I consider anti-journalism discussion that happens on Twitter right now is being driven by venture capitalists who have a lot to lose when journalism does its job. And I think there's a really dark, almost fascist energy that is coming off of some of those VC tweets. So that's just something that I keep a close eye on. All that said, though, people do feel really irritated with tech coverage sometimes. So if I'm trying to find like what in there that I think is worth actually digging out and reflecting on, it's this idea that I still haven't written a column about that I need to like soon, because I feel like I'm talking about it to someone every week now. And the idea is what I call platform determinism. And it's the idea that if something is on Facebook, then Facebook caused it. And even though I think most tech journalists would never say that they ascribe to such an oversimplified view, I actually think that that view informs a lot of the coverage of platforms, right? Like, I read a story over the weekend about the Boogaloo Boys, and the story highlighted many, many times in a relatively short piece the fact that the Boogaloo Boys had communicated on Facebook using Facebook products. No commentary was offered on that because no commentary was needed. And the reason that no commentary was needed is because all of us have absorbed the lessons of platform determinism, which is that because this took place on Facebook, Facebook must answer for the Boogaloo Boys. And of course, there are areas where Facebook should answer for the Boogaloo Boys. I'm sure that algorithmic recommendations help some of those Boogaloo Boys to find each other. But is the fact that they messaged one another on Facebook Messenger hugely relevant to a story about, you know, two people committing a crime spree? I'm not sure that it is. So I think if you work in tech, you are seeing this unstated philosophy. You're seeing this determinism kind of shape everything in the coverage, but nobody has really done their homework and shown their work for how and why they think these platforms are operating, right? Are you really making the case that the Boogaloo Boys would not have happened if Facebook doesn't exist? Then you need to spell that out. And if you don't spell that out, it's going to undermine trust in journalism more broadly. So that's the strain that I think is really warping and undermining trust. And I, you know, have some ideas around how we can get that back, but I would stop there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think it is important, as you say, to distinguish between the sort of the criticisms of tech coverage that are coming from a place of sort of wanting more nuance and the criticisms that are coming from a place of wanting just, you know, optimism and enthusiasm all the time. And I do think that goes to another point I wanted to ask you about, which is that There are wildly varying degrees of knowledge about this area, even though, you know, most people use Facebook. Everyone seems to have an opinion about it. I can't count how many conversations I've had recently with people who said, you know, I watched The Social Dilemma and like this Facebook thing, it seems really bad. And, you know, some of those people are going to be reading your tweets. There are going to be some people who sort of know a medium amount and say, okay, well, you know, it's really hard for Facebook to handle this kind of thing. And then there are going to be some people who say, well, it is really hard, but also, you know, like they're constantly screwing up, right? Like, how do we know if the Boogaloo Boys are connected to what extent Facebook contributed to that? So how do you think about writing and reporting for these different audiences? Is there a risk that if you write something sort of at a higher level that people who are operating with less information to begin with are might get the wrong impression and sort of come away with a sense that, you know, Facebook did cause the Boogaloo Boys, to use an example?
I think it depends on the format. Like if I'm writing a big feature story, I want that to be broadly accessible. So last month I wrote like 5,000 or 6,000 words about what it was like to work inside Facebook this summer, drawing from a lot of internal audio that I had acquired. And I tried not to assume a lot of knowledge there, right? I tried to spell out basically everything that had happened and write it in as accessible a way as I could. When I'm writing my column, you know, particularly now for my paid column, which is going out to like a really small group of people compared to the audience that I was writing for every day on The Verge, I'm assuming a slightly higher level of knowledge. I was actually, you know, I was working on the links for the newsletter today, and I went to mention Gab, which I imagine most of your listeners will know is this sort of free speech absolutist platform that is, you know, sort of de facto a far right platform. And I thought, you know, if I were writing on The Verge, I would have to spell out what Gab is, but I'm just going to assume that everyone who pays for my newsletter like knows what Gab is, right? So I think that kind of thing will change it a little bit. But, you know, my favorite writers about complicated issues always write in a relatively straightforward and accessible way. I'm thinking of Matt Levine, who writes this newsletter that's mostly about finance for Bloomberg, and he's writing for an incredibly elite audience that knows finance inside and out. And he still approaches every edition of his newsletter like a high school teacher, you know, and is just sort of very like chatty and conversational. So that's an approach I try to take as well, because I find that when I do that, I'm able to get away from the minutiae. We'll get into the minutiae, but I like to start by framing it at a high level to talk about what is at stake. And I think if you force yourself to say that in a really concise way, you almost can't help but making the subject matter more accessible.
So going back to your interview with Sarah Jong for a minute, you made a point that I think is really interesting, that platforms are too big for us to understand in a way. And that's something that I think about a lot, maybe in part because it's kind of comforting to tell myself that, you know, no one else understands this either and not worry about all the things that I don't understand. But I'd love to have you expand more on what you mean by that, especially because, you know, to what extent is the issue that these platforms are too big in and of themselves, like in their internal operations? And to what extent is it just that they're hard to understand because they touch on so many different societal and cultural and political fissures in their operations?
I mean, both of those things are absolutely true. This whole idea that platforms are too big got in my head a couple years ago when I read Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation series of books. And I read this.
Oh my God, they're so good. I just have to shill for them. Yes. Everyone should read them.
They're so good. And I read this review, and I believe it was the LA Times review of books or the LA review of books. And it compared some of the phenomena described in Annihilation to this concept of the hyper object, which was, it's some academic theorist had sort of coined this term to illustrate concepts that are too big to get your head all the way around. And climate change was apparently used by this academic to describe one of those phenomena. It just sort of has so many implications, ramifications. It's causing so much day to day that like no individual human can understand it. And as I was reading about this, I thought, this is exactly how I feel about Facebook. You have a platform of 3 billion people conducting an enormous amount of speech there. The platform itself, you know, it's a marketplace, it's a speech platform, it's gaming hardware, it's an enterprise software company. And into that morass, an individual reporter or academic or citizen tries to learn a little bit.
And then, you know, because we're humans, we try to like make a judgment where we measure what we know of the good versus what we know of the bad, and then have some kind of feeling about this company in general. And what I've observed is most people just learn like 10 or 12 bad things about Facebook and they say, well, the hell with this, right? Which I'm, you know, like I am sympathetic to, but my job is not actually to be the final moral weighing mechanism for understanding whether Facebook is good or bad. My job is to understand Facebook as well as I can and to sort of bring back to you day to day the best and most important things that we have learned about this platform so that over time, all of us can do a better job of weighing this thing, but also, you know, designing policies or regulations about this thing. But I always want to foreground the challenge of doing it because, you know, human beings are mostly innumerate anyway. And when you get to the scale of billions, you know, our minds just turn into mush. So I feel very feeble trying to investigate these platforms, but I also just find it useful to begin from a standpoint of humility when I do, because I generally learn more. But absolutely, these platforms are too big to understand. And, you know, if I feel this way, like, you know, imagine what the average person just trying to kind of get a gut read on how the platforms are doing must feel. Like, I think about that all the time.
So sort of tying that in perhaps with the idea of platform determinism that you mentioned earlier, your very first platform and newsletter was headed, "Trump is a problem platforms can't fix." And I sort of see that as building on a theme in your work about the difference between platform problems and internet problems. And maybe sort of now, based on this sort of theme, we might add another bucket, something like society problems.
Yeah.
Can you maybe sort of expand on that idea in your work a bit and what you see falling into those buckets and what you think the broader discourse about them misses?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to remember what the inciting incident was that got me to write my first column about it. But one of the things I've been trying to do over time as part of an effort to just see these platforms for what they are and understand what makes them unique is to try to isolate what makes something like Facebook different from one of the web forums that I used to visit, or, you know, just like a website that I used to visit. And so that sort of led me to this framing of platform problems versus internet problems. And I'm still working on it, by the way. Like this doesn't feel like a solved thing for me. But, you know, the internet broadly helps people to find each other. It helps good people find each other. It helps bad people find each other. It provides a really broad speech surface on which people can say almost anything to almost anyone. And there are a variety of problems that come from that. For example, you know, people will post horrible images online that, you know, that they have no right to post. And that is a problem of the internet existing. And then on the platform side, when you think about like what really makes this thing different, and it's like, well, they have sharing mechanisms, right? You can retweet, you can share a Facebook post, you can share a Tumblr post. That can enable an individual piece of speech to travel all the way around the world more or less instantly. That feels pretty new. That's a platform problem. The other big platform problem is that they have recommendation algorithms, right? So you'll be in a new moms group in Brooklyn and Facebook's algorithm, not knowing any better, will say, hey, you know, what new moms tend to love is this group that says that vaccine will kill their babies. And so next thing you know, you have a huge anti-vax movement in the country. Facebook has, by the way, since stopped recommending that, but they did do that for a long time and it was really bad. So like that is clearly a platform problem. So trying to separate those two things out, I think, is sort of a necessary first step toward designing an effective like policy or regulatory intervention, if that's something you're interested in doing.
So if you could have one big ask from various platforms tomorrow, like, you know, one thing that you could change about everything that you think about all day long, what would it be?
I would just slow them down. Like this is increasingly, I just wonder, like, why can any tweet get 100,000 retweets in an hour? Is there a benefit that comes from that? Maybe if there's a tornado coming to your house and the National Weather Service shares that, like, that's information that you want to have. But I'm prepared to accept that there are some positive benefits that come from viral content distribution, but I see fewer and fewer benefits about really speedy content distribution, particularly in these decentralized environments where any actor can share any information instantly around the world. Like, you know, if you're CNN, yes, you can reach the entire world instantly, but there's some editorial infrastructure there. They have some good incentives not to, you know, share crazy, you know, alarmist hoaxes or whatever. So I would just look for more ways to slow the platforms down, make it harder, and not even necessarily make it harder, but just make it slower for information to spread and give the truth time to put its shoes on before the lie gets all the way around the world.
Yeah, I love the idea of friction, and it just seems like such a no-brainer. Although, on the other hand, it always seems that people are really, really in favor of friction until it applies to them. Like, if you watch people's reaction at the moment to being forced to click an extra button to just retweet something, it's just unbelievable. Like, how dare you silence me like this? So anyway, I just do wonder whether it's something we all love in theory, but then if the platforms actually got serious about it, we would mutiny. So we'll see. So just to sort of finish up big picture, as you sort of set out on this new adventure with your new newsletter, what's the big thing that you are watching over the next year in this space?
What is the biggest thing that I'm watching? I mean, I think I would have to say antitrust right now. Like, that is so on my mind. You know, who wins the election, I think, has huge implications for basically everything that I write about. We'll see if it has huge implications for antitrust. But, you know, a world in which Google has to re-architect search and Facebook is maybe prohibited, possibly forever, from buying another social network, is maybe even required to spin off an Instagram or a WhatsApp, that is really a brave new world. And then, of course, if Instagram and WhatsApp are spun out, then they're going to face all of the issues that we've just been talking about, and how nimbly will they be able to address any of them. So that just feels really, really consequential to me. But, you know, I feel like there's also a list of 80 things that are super consequential to me. And that's why I have to write 4 times a week.
All right. On that note, Casey, thank you so much for joining us.
Your questions were great. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast miniseries on disinformation. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare Podcast feed, and we'll be back for another episode next Thursday. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer is Zachary Frank, and our producer is Jen Patcha Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on whatever app you use, and thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.